And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my guest host, Dave Cushing. Our first guest this morning, Dr. One Pagan, has written Strange Survivors, How Organisms Attack and Defend the Game of Life. In the evolutionary arms race that's raged on since life began, organisms have developed an endless array and variety of survival strategies. From sharp claws to brute strength, camouflage to venom, all these tools and abilities share one purpose: to keep the bearer alive long enough to reproduce, helping the species avoid extinction. In Strange Survivors, biologist One Pagan takes us on a tour of the improbable, the ingenious, and just part plain bizarre ways that creatures fight for life.
John, that sounds amazing, and good morning. Hey, folks, I'm Dave Cushing. Our second guest on the show is Michael Horkachuk. Michael works for NASA, and he manages the on-site government representative's office at SpaceX for NASA's $2.6 billion commercial crew program contract, which is going to put humans from America back up to the space station before long. Since 2012, SpaceX has flown many unmanned resupply missions to the International Space Station. And later this year, if the certification happens, we'll be flying manned missions.
Right around the corner. These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Chris Wissner, store manager of JANS, a longtime supporter of KPCW. JANS guides fly fishing excursions to local waters and private ranches. Our fly shop is stocked with the gear you need, and our guides are ready to take you to the river. Serving Park City for over 30 years, JANS Mountain Recreation Experts. 649-4949 or JANS.com.
G'day, this is Ashley from Campus Coffee, happy to sponsor programming on KPCW. We can't wait to serve the Park City locals this winter. We're excited by our breakfast and lunch menu to complement our espresso drinks. Campus Coffee is open daily at the base of Park City Mountain Resort, up the stairs from the ice rink next to the Adirondack chairs. CampusCoffee.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Dave Cushing, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is Dr. One Pagan, who has written Strange Survivors, How Organisms Attack and Defend in the Game of Life. Every living thing on this planet has developed a time-tested arsenal of weapons and defenses. Some of these, however, are decidedly more unusual than others. In this funny, fascinating field guide to nature's most colorful characters, you'll meet killer snails, social bacteria, and an animal with toxic elbows. But Strange Survivors is more than a collection of curiosities. It's a love letter to science. Dr. One Pagan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And let me just start by saying a fascinating book, really straightforward, easy to read. I love the structure of it. And not only is it a love letter to science, but specifically to evolution. Am I right about that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And thank you for your kind words. I mean, it means a lot to me, really.
Yeah, so evolution is the key, and it's the introduction. Then it gets pretty quickly into your concept of the evolutionary arms race that leads one species to try to outflank another one. Can you give some examples of the evolutionary arms races?
Sure thing, but I have to clarify that that's not my concept. It's been published for quite a long time. There's many scientists who have actually framed the evolutionary process in terms of such arms races. Some of the ones that are most commonly known in terms of book publishing and whatnot are, for example, when we talk about cheetahs, for example, this feline that is so fast that, you know, it's rather adept at capturing prey. the things that when they are going to capture the antelopes, a certain proportion of them are going to be a little faster than the others. Those who are actually able to escape the cheetahs are going to be able to survive and therefore reproduce. In the next generation, they are going to be even more a little bit faster. And in contrast, there's going to be a little bit, the cheetahs in themselves are going to be a little bit faster too. So the idea about this is that in time, there's going to be like an escalating war race or arms race between the two types of organisms. This type of activities are also seen with venomous animals, with anything that evolution can come up with. It can be understood in terms of evolutionary arm races.
That's fantastic. Well, let me just rewind a little bit and say, what led you to write this book in the first place?
Oh, because I'm in love with biology, period. That's an easy question to ask. I am actually trained in general sciences for my bachelor's, and in my master's and PhD were in biochemistry and pharmacology, respectively. But the thing is that I like nature, particularly biology, in all its, its majestic beauty, okay? I don't know if I'm going to make too much sense, but sometimes I'm a little nostalgic of the things that I'll never see. Okay, let me give you an example. And I'm talking about biodiversity. I will never be likely be able to see an actual dinosaur, what they actually looked like, okay? So that's one of the things. And all of the millions of species that have come and go in our planet that we may know anything about them ever. And all the species that are presently in our planet, which are disappearing at a breakneck pace, as it were. So that being said, in a more optimistic note, I love the majesty of biology. Okay, how everything can be studied from the molecular level all the way up to behavior. And all of that is biology.
And you're helping all of us love biology through some of these examples. Vespa mandarinia, the Asian giant hornet, tough customer. Mm. It's got a mean streak. It's 2 inches long. It likes to attack honeybees. When it attacks honeybees, it just decimates their hives, it eats their larvae, it eats the honeybees. I mean, it's just a tough, tough, mean-spirited hornet. Talk about the bee ball, because this is just fascinating.
You just touched upon my favorite example of the whole book, even though I love them all, but that's my favorite example.
Mine too.
That's the thing. Yeah, because that hornet is so, again, it's a mean-spirited, as you say, but it's also rather tough in terms of their carapace, their cuticle. So the bees cannot sting them as if they were going to do with any other predator or something like that. Now, what they have evolved is a certain response in which like 500 bees or so, and this is only has only been described in Japanese honeybees for some reason. And they belong to the same species as the regular honeybees, but it's a behavioral response. So at any rate, those 500 bees surround the hornet, okay? They start to beat their wings in unison, and they raise the temperature of the interior of the bee ball by 5 or 6 degrees, I think it is. And in addition to that, the carbon dioxide content of the inside of the bee ball is increased. So in an essence, they cook and suffocate the hornet, all right? So one-on-one, one bee has no hope of being able to survive a hornet attack. But with cooperation, they have been able to do that. I mean, it's fascinating how that can evolve.
Raise the temperature, increase the CO2. A bee ball of 500 bees, it's just incredible. I'll tell you one of my other pieces of the book which fascinated me was, you know, humans like to self-medicate, you know, food, drugs, alcohol, there's all sorts of different ways to do it. And it was just really interesting to hear you talk about dolphins and how they self-medicate. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's actually, it's so recent that there's no scientific papers that describe that. This is on all observations by divers. Essentially, what they observed, and it seems to be a regular occurrence, what they do is that they have been observed to take puffer fish, which is a particular type of fish which is known to produce a toxin called tetrodotoxin, which is interesting in its own right. I talk about it in my book as well. What they have been observed to do is that they pass the puffer fish, as if they were passing a joint, essentially. Okay? So,
well, they share. It's important to share.
Yeah, that's the image. And so, and then they have observed behavioral changes in the dolphins. Like, they start swimming, like, upside down. They look very mellow. When they put a mirror, they become fascinated with their own reflection. I mean, that's something, again, fascinating. And, in fact, that's the topic of my next book. I cannot talk too much about it.
Okay.
But I'm going to talk about that in my next book. I'll certainly keep you posted.
It's Dave again. Hey, in your evolutionary introduction, you say that organisms have three things in common. They need to get energy from the environment. They need to avoid becoming food for other organisms. And then they're compelled to pass on their genetic information. That's a great summary. And
yep, thank you.
And then you work that into the first section of the actual Strange Survivors, electric fish. So can you talk a little bit about how these organisms can store electricity and use that for survival?
Okay, so any type of organism, as far as cells are concerned, deal with unequal distribution of charged particles in and out of the cell. Okay, so that's not specific of electric organisms or anything like that. The beauty of electric organisms is that they have learned to harness the transport of such molecules, electrically charged molecules, in such a way that they can generate macrocurrents in the order of like 400 volts, 800 volts in the case of certain electric eels. So what they do is that they have a modified muscle tissue, okay? And scientists call those electric organs. And they are cells arranged like stacked on top of each other like a battery. Okay, that's one thing. The second characteristic is that they are full of a specific receptor called the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, which is the same receptor that we use in our normal muscles to contract and relax muscles, so we can send the message from the brain to the muscles. The thing is that they have such a high concentration of those receptors in their electric organs that when they activate the organ, the combination of the cells stacked like a battery and the really high concentration of ion channels, it generates a macrocurrent, and they are able to actually induce the release of that electric current at will. And that's, again, fascinating. Electric eels, they pack a punch, I mean, like 800 volts. Electric rays is about maybe 450, and electric catfish, which I was not aware that they exist, they're in the 400 volts as well.
It's amazing. And are there any electric-bearing animals that use that sort of charge who live out of the water? Or is water required for that, or is that just how evolution
is? So far, only water-living organisms have been described as being fully electrical in that sense, because we're talking about conductivity here. Because in order for electricity to be conducted in the air, it would have to be of a potency of, lightning,
right.
Essentially.
Thousands and millions of volts.
However, I believe in something that we read a couple of weeks ago, there are stories of electric eels that are in a nest, and a horse will be crossing the water. And the electric eel, there's been cases of the electric eel jumping out of the water and electrocuting the horse, killing the horse.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was actually described by Dr. Catania not so long ago, but it was actually reported by Humboldt, the great explorer. And they used to fish electric eels in the Amazon and rivers like that actually, it was kind of a cruel practice. They will actually send horses or mules, and they will keep them into the lake or the river, and then the electric eels will start jumping on them and striking them with their electricity and whatnot. Many horses and mules will die, but then the eels will be kind of discharged, and the fishermen will be able to collect them easier without being shocked.
We just got a text.
Actually, yeah.
We just got a text from a listener who said, "Hey, man, can you pass me the pufferfish only on KPCW in Park City?" So
well, he may not want to do that because tetrodotoxin is very toxic to humans.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty tough here, but I understand that. Thank you for counseling us. So I wanted to ask you sort of a bizarre question. It's about consciousness. How do we know when a dolphin breaks the surface of the water on an absolutely moonless night and there's thousands of stars burning through the canopy, how do we know that dolphin does not look up at the stars and say, "Hey, we got to go there one day"?
You got to read the first, the introduction of the book, because I present a similar image with a chimpanzee. The thing is that, first of all, we don't know exactly what consciousness is. It doesn't matter who you ask to, we don't know exactly what it is. Second, sometimes I don't even know what I am thinking, let alone what any other person thinks, or even a dolphin. Okay? So we may never know what they are thinking, and this is an idea that was presented in a rather beautiful essay called "What Is It Like to Be a Bat?" Maybe you have heard about it. In the sense that bats are, well, mammals, and they have some characteristics that we have, but they have senses that very few humans have experienced, like echolocation, for example, and all these type of physiological tricks that we don't know. We will never know how is it to be able to echolocate like a dolphin and to image, form an image due to little noises that we may emit and recover by specific organs. We don't even have those organs. But the thing about it is that even though dolphins may be extremely intelligent, and they are by all stretch of the imagination, they have been described as being like that, they don't seem to be technological. They don't have the tools to actually create technology. And that goes to some ideas that I've heard from many other people, in the sense that there may be a lot of intelligent life out there, but if they're not technological, we'll never know about them. And I'm getting a little philosophical here. That's another one of my loves. I teach a course in astrobiology at my university, so I love that topic too.
Well, before Cro-Magnon species were developing tools, weren't they self-aware? Could a dolphin be self-aware today, although it hasn't built tools or technology yet?
Well, they, to the best of my understandings, dolphins have been shown to be self-aware. You see several techniques. For example, they can paint like a symbol on their forehead, and when they present them with their reflection, they know it's their own body. That's kind of a standard test for that. And dolphins have been known to pass that test. So I'm pretty sure they're self-aware, but again, in the end, it's a guess.
Folks, we're talking with One Pagan about his book Strange Survivors and How Organisms Attack and Defend in the Game of Life here on Cool Science Radio. Here's an organism you wouldn't think of as necessarily very aggressive, but can you talk about the killer snail a little bit?
Oh, well, that's another favorite. So that's particularly mind-boggling because they represent three characteristics that you wouldn't expect to find in one animal, okay? They're snails, all right? So, and they are not particularly fast snails, okay? They're as slow as any snail can be, right?
Right.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is that they, many species of comb snails, actually all of them that they have been described, they possess the capacity to synthesize venom, okay?
Right.
So venom as in toxic venom.
Yes.
And they have developed a series of organs that enables them to inject those venoms to particular prey. And a particular subset of killer snails, they actually exclusively hunt fish, okay? And not particularly slow fish, fast fish, okay? So they have evolved a series of venom cocktails that are able to kill fish in less than a second, perhaps, okay? Which makes sense, because once they sting the fish, they kill it, they want to go and consume it. And if the fish is able to swim, I don't know, 20 yards or something like that, by the time the slow snail gets to the fish, some other snail will have eaten.
It's amazing. Okay? Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you done?
So, and again, they have been specialized to hunt fish in that sense. In a biomedical sense, we have been, and by we, I mean scientists, we have been able to get some compounds from those killer snails, and we have been beginning to use them in the biomedical sciences. There's a specific toxin of one of the snails that is being used to to alleviate otherwise intractable pain. So that's a really nice thing to have in the biomedical arsenal, as it were.
Absolutely. We have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to comment that the book not only deals with attacks and defenses, and venoms and toxins and spikes and all those things. But then it also deals at the end with cooperation among creatures to survive, like the bees in a ring. But what are some other examples of cooperation, and what can we draw from that to our human condition?
Well, the very first example that we could talk about is, ourselves, essentially. A single person with what nature gave us, no matter how smart we are, against a tiger, well, it's game over, because we don't have the physical capacity to win in that battle. But many different humans which come together and cooperate will come up with technology. Well, look where we are right now. We are not the fastest organisms. We are not the biggest. We are not the strongest. And, well, here we are. That being said, we can argue that our type of life billions of years ago started with a certain measurement of cooperation. When we talk about multicellular organisms, cells must cooperate with each other in order to survive in these particular organisms. In organisms like us, well, we are divided in tissues, organs, and whatnot, specialized cells, which cooperate for the benefit, as it were, of the full organism. But millions of years ago, there were no multicellular organisms. What's the transition between unicellular organisms and when they decided, and of course I'm personifying in this sense, when they decided to cooperate and multicellular organisms evolved eventually. So cooperation is at least as powerful as competition, as it were.
Dr. Pagan, we only have about a minute, maybe 2 minutes left. Maybe you could tell us about being careful about the living dead, the biological roots of the zombie myth. Can you tell us about that in about a minute and a half?
Okay, so that relates to the tetrodotoxin compound that we mentioned before. All the traditions of voodoo and the original ideation of zombies seems to have originated from certain concoctions that people from that are adept at that religion use to actually lower the physiology, and for all intents and purposes, the people is dead. But it's not actually dead. It's going to be like in a rather dormant state. In 30 seconds, it's very hard to do this. but it originated with tetrodotoxin, essentially,
I got to tell you, I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone that had such an affection for venoms. You really like venoms, don't you?
I really like them for many reasons. I mean, I started my career working on certain venoms, related to the electric organ that I mentioned before. And they are fascinating because, again, nature is the best chemical engineer, period. Okay, because everything that we can do in chemistry laboratories, nature has done that before, or very much so, with billions of years of practice through evolution. So it's an inexhaustible source of new and interesting compounds.
Dr. One Pagan, he's written Strange Survivors, How Organisms Attack and Defend in the Game of Life. It's not only educational and informative, but it's a lot of fun to read, and I suspect you had a lot of fun writing it.
Oh, yes, I did.
Hey, thanks for joining us, and we definitely want to talk to you about dolphins and pufferfish in the future.
All righty. Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and keep on reading.
We will. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care.
So, Dr. One Pagan, when we return, we're going to be having a conversation with Michael Huckabuck, who is from NASA, and he manages a very special relationship with SpaceX to get manned missions back to the International Space Station and beyond.
Fantastic.
Yeah. We'll be back right after these messages. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts a variety of events throughout the winter season, including our new Seven Summits Challenge, weekly live music, Spring Groove, concerts, and more. More information about events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Dave Cushing. Before we introduce our next guest, I want to share with everyone the latest news with Park City's RoboMiners, one of Park City High School's robotics teams. As you may recall, I attended a robotics competition back in December. There were 35 teams across the great state of Utah. They all competed in a very exciting day, a full day of competition with their various robots. Three teams, the RoboMiners, the Inconceivables, and the Nuclear Mines, all from Park City, made it to the semifinals with the RoboMiners winning it all. On December 28th, we had the three teams here on Cool Science. We also had the all-girls robotic team, Ultima and Dominarum. And then 2 weeks ago, the top 72 teams from 12 Western states competed in Spokane, Washington. After 3 days of competition, 9 qualifying matches, and 4 elimination matches, the Park City RoboMiners won the entire competition. They are the super regional champions. That means they will be advancing to the Worlds in Houston on April 18th. Stay tuned to Cool Science Radio. We're going to update you on the World competition and also the RoboMiners. I'm sure we'll have them back on the show and we'll have some fun. Our next guest this morning, Michael Horkachuk. Michael works for NASA, and he manages the on-site government representative's office at SpaceX for NASA's $2.6 billion commercial crew program contract. Now, since 2012, SpaceX has flown many unmanned resupply missions to the International Space Station. Michael and his group at NASA are working hard towards certification of SpaceX Crew Dragon, which will allow SpaceX to fly manned missions to the International Space Station possibly as soon as 2019-2020. Michael Horkachuk, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello.
Nice to have you.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
And also, I'm actually kind of glad that it's raining today because I felt guilty about having you in the early morning when you know, the slopes are all the best. You could be skiing. But I understand you got some skiing in already.
Yeah, we got 4 great days in at Deer Valley. It was fantastic.
Okay, good. Tell us about the relationship between SpaceX and NASA that you manage.
Okay, so we have two contractors under the Commercial Crew Program, SpaceX and Boeing. So they're, we like to incentivize the, each of them with a little bit of competition, so it makes them more motivated to get things done quickly. And SpaceX is the partner that I'm working with, and we have some other NASA people working with the Boeing partner. They're both building to the same requirement set to be able to take astronauts up to the space station. Since we retired the space shuttle a number of years ago, we haven't had a way of launching U.S. astronauts up to the International Space Station, of which we're a big partner. So we've been buying rides from the Russians for quite a few years. In fact, three astronauts just launched yesterday up to the space station. Two of them were NASA astronauts. So we're hoping that this program will be able to start launching U.S. astronauts from American soil again up to the space station.
It's been since 2011, since STS-135, I think that was the last space shuttle, went up from Cape Canaveral. So it's about time we started putting manned missions out of Cape Canaveral again. I mean, that's what it's all about, and it's very exciting. I wanted to ask you, there are many differences between NASA and SpaceX and the technologies and the systems and the way things are done, but culturally, the companies are so different because SpaceX is kind of like the Wild West, and NASA is this very established, very, you know, I guess it's okay to say more conservative type company. Culturally, is that a challenge in managing a relationship like this?
Yeah, I guess I'd say NASA is fairly conservative, especially when it comes to manned missions. Under the COTS program, it was an unmanned mission, and it was a fairly high-risk development program that I managed with SpaceX. So we're allowed to take more risks than we normally would because it was an unmanned mission. The old saying was we were going to launch T-shirts and Tang up to the space station. So it was low-value cargo that we could afford to lose once in a while. But once it's a manned mission, the game changes dramatically. And we put a lot more oversight into making sure that everything's going to work correctly. So far, we've already had a pad abort test. So once you have a manned mission, you need an escape system in case something goes wrong with the rocket. So we've already done a test with SpaceX where they've simulated something going wrong with the rocket on the pad and been able to lift the capsule off the pad and drop it into the ocean with parachutes and safely recover it so the crew would be safe. Right now we have an unmanned mission to space station. It's called Demo 1. That's currently slated for about August timeframe of this year. The vehicle is in good shape. It's in system level testing right now at SpaceX. Right after that, we're going to do a high altitude abort test. So somewhere around max Q, the maximum aerodynamic pressure on the vehicle, they'll punch the capsule off the top of the rocket and make sure that it can escape safely in case the rocket was breaking up at that point in the mission, in the trajectory where you have the most dynamic forces. And then eventually, they're trying to make it by the end of the year, we'll have a manned flight to the space station. It'll be two NASA astronauts in the capsule flying all the way to the space station. A little optimistic to catch the end of the year, but you got to have a target.
That's right.
Last summer, I had the pleasure of reading the Elon Musk biography by the Business Week writer. Pretty interesting fellow, and he's the head of and founder of SpaceX. So he seems to be a hands-on CEO, and does he participate in your team meetings between NASA and his company?
He used to in the early days. He does less of that nowadays. He interacts with his own people, and we have a lot of SpaceX people that are in our meetings jointly. In fact, we have a lot of meetings throughout the week. Where we have specific disciplines that we're meeting, the structures team, the avionics team, the material science group. There's a lot of different parachutes, and there's just a lot of different forums where we're interacting between NASA and SpaceX, making sure that they understand the requirements, they're building correctly to the requirements and testing to those requirements correctly. And then we have a lot of joint tests in the program where we're, in fact, there's a docking system at the Johnson Space Center in Houston where your robotics competition is going to be, where we're simulating a docking event between the SpaceX capsule and the space station. There's a docking system on the space station, and they have a 6 degree of freedom test bed at the Johnson Space Center where they put the SpaceX docking system on it, and it simulates a docking event with the space station. And then we compare that to the dynamic models that we have to make sure that the dynamic models accurately represent how the vehicle will really behave. And there's a lot of joint tests like that. The communication system between the spacecraft and the space station gets tested to make sure that you can transmit data and voice between the two vehicles and the TDRS satellites. When you have a spacecraft that's going 17,500 miles an hour, from launch to that speed is about 10 minutes. And it's going around the Earth every 90 minutes at that speed. So a full loop around the Earth every 90 minutes, and you're trying to catch up to a space station that's going that fast. You can't always have coverage with the ground on with a ground satellite dish. So we have these big satellites up in space that can catch it, catch the vehicle when it's on the other side of the Earth, and relay data.
In the book, there was this section about how Musk was pushing the SpaceX developers to find commercially available radio equipment for their initial launches. But that has to interface with these satellite-based radio things, so that's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, they've tried to be very cost-conscious throughout all their development.
And is that kind of pervasive still in their philosophy?
Yeah, they keep a close eye on the budget and the costs. They're trying to be a commercially viable venture and be, I don't know how to say it, more affordable.
Right.
He'd really like to get the cost of going to space down dramatically, like orders of magnitude. And part of this reusability of his rockets, I think, is the first step. The way he's explained it in the past is if you built a 747 and you launched it one time, it flew from here to Paris or somewhere, nobody could afford to fly. But that's not what we do. It lands, you do an inspection, you refuel it, and you fly it again. And he'd like to get to that state with spacecraft. Not quite as easy because the physics and the environments that it's going through are much more strenuous than air flight. But some progress.
Were you there when those two rocket boosters came down?
I was at SpaceX. I wasn't in Florida.
Okay.
It would have been great to be in Florida. Yeah.
So the reusability is, of course, very important, but also Musk has a philosophy of vertical integration. And I remember Gus Grissom back in the Gemini program used to say, I'm sitting on top of this candle, and there have been like 5,000 contractors that were all awarded business for their little piece that they provided for lowest price and all that sort of thing. And you start to think about the complexity of integrating all these other companies' products. And Elon Musk, I remember, and I got this from the book as well, because we interviewed the author here on the program that did the authorized biography of Musk. He calculated that raw materials for building a rocket were only 3% of the sales price of a rocket. And by applying vertical integration, he could produce about 85% of launch hardware in-house. And then using modular approaches of software engineering, they could put this all together at a factor of 10 less for what they would charge their customers, and at the same time still be able to achieve a 65 or 70% gross margin. So that it's just fascinating. The way he looks at things, he looks at things completely different. He's got the reusability, the vertical integration, things that have not been done before.
Yeah, I think Big Aerospace used to do more of that, and then they've kind of farmed a lot of the specialty parts out to specific contractors that are really good at doing that. And the downside to that is you have a contract, you have to write a specification for exactly how that part's going to work. You have a bunch of contract people. Anytime the two parts don't exactly mesh together, you have to do a contract mod, and there's negotiations, and it's a burden, and it takes time and money to to have that overhead. Whereas if you're building it in-house, the boss says, we're going to change it to look like this. You change it to look
like
that.
That's right.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Michael Horkachuk. Michael works for NASA. He manages a very special relationship for our country, and that's the relationship between NASA and SpaceX, which is going through a certification process for the Commercial Crew Program contract, which will allow them to have manned missions to the International Space Station. And when we're talking about the reusability of the Falcon, when you looked at the Falcon Heavy, the two smaller boosters landed on land, and the larger, I think, the liquid fuel was supposed to land on the drone ship out in the ocean, but it didn't. Had some technical problems, and I was wondering if it was easier to land these on land. Why wouldn't we do that versus over the water? And then somebody explained to me that when you're chasing an International Space Station, is it 17,500 miles per hour? Or what's
the 17,500 miles an hour.
I mean, when you see the rocket go up, you always think this rocket's shooting straight up in the sky, and it is, but pretty quickly it moves horizontal and starts chasing that International Space Station. And I think the window of opportunity has to be only a couple of seconds.
Yeah, for these launches, they're instantaneous launch windows. So you have to launch exactly that second, or you scrub for the day and try again the next day. And it's all a matter of how much performance margin does the vehicle have for that particular flight. The shuttle at times would have a couple of minute launch window because it had a lot of performance margin. So it could chase the space station and catch up to it a little bit easier than some of these other vehicles.
Yeah.
And the reason they come back to the pad, it's certainly easier to land on land because it's not moving. But you have downstream landings because of performance. So if you have a heavier vehicle or a heavier satellite on top, you need all that performance, and you're going downrange, and it's you don't have enough fuel in the remaining booster come all the way back. So you land at that downrange drone ship in order to minimize how much fuel impacts there are.
If you fire from Cape Canaveral or Kennedy, and what do they call it these days?
Cape Canaveral is the Air Force side, and Kennedy Space Center is the NASA side.
Oh,
they're
okay.
Right next to each other.
Okay.
So they're cooperative, but they're two separate government sites.
So I guess if you're shooting from from there, you know, from Florida, from the Florida coast, you're chasing this space station the entire time. You're going to end up in the middle of the ocean when they land that drone?
Yeah, up the Atlantic on the East Coast. Yeah. So the space station's in a 51.6 degree orbit. So you're launching from Florida kind of out over the ocean, but more or less up the East Coast. You want to launch out over the ocean in case something doesn't work with the rocket. You don't want parts falling on habitable areas, right, where people are living. So that's why all these launch sites are out over the coasts. And sometimes they launch out of Vandenberg, and there were some pretty spectacular photos of a sunset launch, and it was backlit. So it looked like when the plume started expanding, people were thinking aliens were coming or something.
Well, the original Mercury, Gemini, Apollo programs used space capsules, right? And then it was a space shuttle. Now we're going back to space capsule, but landing on land instead of ocean landings for the capsule. So what's the change in philosophy there?
Yeah, actually, SpaceX is going to land in the water.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, with parachutes in the water.
Correct.
So the test video I saw was a land test, or was that a Boeing test?
It might have been a Boeing test.
All right, so...
And there was a period of time where SpaceX was thinking about propulsive landing, where they were not going to have parachutes. Well, they were going to have parachutes as a backup, but they were going to propulsively land, similar to the way they do the rockets.
Well, how come they decided not to?
The certification process and the amount of redundancy that you require for a manned mission, you wouldn't be lighting those engines until you're really close to the ground and there's no other choice but to have those engines work. It was a big undertaking, I guess.
So then it's a parachute landing in a body of water where? Or does it depend on the mission?
Yeah, right now the plan is somewhere off the coast of Florida, fairly close to Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
But there are some alternate landing sites in the Gulf of Mexico. And then we have the Air Force working with us so that if the capsule has a problem, it can land anywhere in the world, and they'll be there with their rescue forces to recover the astronauts.
And then for a sea landing, is it a naval, U.S. Navy involvement, or is it private ship recovery now?
If it's a nominal landing, SpaceX will have a ship that recovers them.
Nominal meaning?
Nothing went wrong. If something goes wrong and it's off course, then the Air Force would take over and have the recovery forces. So we'd have a C-5 with a group of divers ready to go at a moment's notice and be at the site. And then after that, they'd call in whatever ships are available.
Interesting.
When I think of all the different programs that we have underway, and on the unmanned side, Cassini is one of my favorite. You know, we went out to Saturn and we were out there for, 12, 14 years, and everything we did there, putting a red roadster up in the air, Falcon Heavy, BFR, whatever that stands for, we should probably not define it on NPR, and all these other projects. Absolutely, for me, the most important thing is getting manned missions out of Florida coast again under the United States flag. I mean, there is nothing more important. And you look, so with this importance and all that, you look so well rested. I would think when you came in this morning, I was thinking, Michael's going to come in here. He must be up all night trying to figure out how all this stuff is going to work together. But you look very, very rested.
We have a big team at NASA that's making sure all the different pieces are working well together. And I'm in the plant checking on progress of the actual manufacturing and build of the vehicle and testing of the vehicle and reporting back and making sure that the NASA people understand what SpaceX is doing and the SpaceX people understand where NASA's coming from with some of our requirements and concern areas. So I've been through some of these development programs before. I think they're on track in the big picture of things, and now it's just a matter of executing.
We were looking at your resume, David and I, and going way back, you've been integrating sophisticated components and spacecraft for SpaceX, for NASA, for a number of years. You have a lot of experience with this.
Yeah, like I said, I was the NASA project manager for the original development program that we awarded SpaceX when they built the first Falcon 9 and Dragon capsule. And they flew two test flights for me. And then we determined it was operational, and they've flown 14 cargo resupply missions so far. The 14th one is on the launch pad getting ready to go. Before that, I managed the integration of all the major science experiments onto the space station. So all the interfaces between those different types of science experiments, large furnaces, glove boxes to do material science work in, human research facilities, making sure they understood what the interfaces on the space station were for power, thermal data, and all the safety aspects of being safe in a manned spacecraft. So I've done a lot of that work for a time.
And the Dragon 2 capsule, that's what we're talking about. Is that correct?
Correct.
The Dragon 2 will be able to house up to seven humans, or six.
The NASA requirement is for four.
Mm-hmm.
So they're building the first vehicles to accommodate four astronauts. Like I said, the first demo flight will only have two, a pilot and a commander. But it'll eventually have room for four. I think if they do a commercial mission, they could potentially have more, up to seven, I think has been some of the design work that they've done. They've built the life support systems and equipment to be able to accommodate seven people.
Because Musk was talking about a moon flyby where he would put some people up that were paying some big money and just give them a little ride around the moon, it's 255,000 miles from here, but so that would, be probably a a Dragon 2 configured for more people?
Yeah, I don't know if it would have more or less, depending on the length of the mission. Your life support consumables would get used up depending on how long it is. So it's kind of sized for the NASA mission, which is about 100 hours of flight time with a little bit of contingency built into that 100 hours. So you're not looking at a moon-based mission. It's a quick rendezvous to the space station and a return with potential weather wave-offs.
The main mission is to get Americans launched from the United States up to space and not do it with the Russians anymore. Is this a geopolitical program, or is it financially more viable to just do it from here with our own technology, would you say? Is it known?
I don't know if I should. I'm not in a position to really talk politics, I think.
Right.
I think it's just good. The United States has been the leader in space for years and years, and having retired the space shuttle, it's a shame not to have an ability to launch our own astronauts up to an international space station that we've been more than a 50% partner in developing and still own more than 50% of the space up on the space station. And there's a lot of science research that's going on up there, and we want to be able to make use of that big investment.
Right. John?
We're going to take a short break for just a couple of underwriters, and then when we come back, we'll have some final thoughts with Michael Morkachuk from NASA. Stay with us. This is Cool Science Radio.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Have you been to our ReStore lately? You will find treasures every visit because we receive new donations of furniture, appliances, and building materials daily. Even better, your purchases support local hardworking families. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Dave Cushing and JW here, and we are with Michael Morkachuk from NASA. We have just probably another minute, a minute and a half. Is there anything else you'd like folks to know about this program?
Oh, I think it's a great investment by the American people. Being able to launch U.S. astronauts back to the U.S. Overall, it also has been changing the game a little bit. Part of the COTS program enabled this technology with U.S. industry. Part of NASA's charter is to pass on the technology that we develop to U.S. industry to make us more competitive. And in the launch market, the U.S. was the leader in launching satellites and other things into space for years and years. And then the cost got too high, and satellite providers started going overseas to get their launches. SpaceX, in the way that they've developed their rocket and their cost model, have been able to start winning contracts back from overseas providers so that